Open Radio Show with your host, Lonnie Clark. We stand together and accept that we now live in a world transformed by Fukushima. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time here on UCY.TV Radio. We relentlessly engage every ear that listens. We expose and confront the complete lack of accountability for the nuclear industry. Consider social engineering programs who view our bodies, minds, and souls as assets on a balance sheet. We discuss vital current issues, interview activists, and engage our audience in an effort to allow all voices to be heard. The Age of Vision radio show creates a venue that all will choose. We encourage our listeners to reclaim their power and their courage to take action and save our planet from the ravages of greed and indifference. Our actions matter. Every voice matters. We remind our listeners that happiness is resistance. Love is greater than fear.
Good morning, UCY.TV radio listeners. This is Lonnie Clark with the Age of Fission radio show. Today is actually August 20th, 2017. It's 9 o'clock in the morning here. This is a pre-recorded interview that I'm doing with Mr. Chuck Johnson from Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. He is scheduled on our show for the 23rd, but he is traveling overseas, and I thought it might be helpful for all of us, for us to hear about his adventures overseas long before so we can get him on by the 23rd, but his schedule was too tight, so we're pre-recording. So thanks, Chuck, for making this extra effort to be on our show before you venture to Europe. I appreciate your time.
It's never a waste of time or extra effort to be on your show, Lonnie. I enjoy it a lot.
Well, thank you so much. And why don't you tell our listeners where exactly you're going, because this is a pretty big event.
I'm going to the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear Wars International Conference, which they hold every 2 or 3 years. This year it's going to be September 3rd through 7th in York, England. And these conferences are the affiliates of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, and Physicians for Social Responsibility is the USA affiliate. It's actually the mother organization of IPPNW. It was formed first before IPPNW.
That's awesome. IPPNW. Is Helen Caldicott going to be there?
I don't know. I kind of doubt it. There was, unfortunately, a bit of a breakup between her and the founders of IPPNW initially.
Okay.
But I think they're, you know, in terms of feelings between the current leadership and her, I think they're actually pretty strong. So it's possible she'll be there. I know that she and Ira Helfand, who's one of the co-presidents of IPPNW, basically revived PSR from a very small organization in the Cambridge area, and were involved in reviving it, and of course Helen Caldicott spread it throughout the United States made it the large organization that it is today.
Is this your first trip to York, England?
No, actually, it's my second. I went there when I was 16 years old, so it's been a while, but it's a beautiful,
awesome.
Beautiful city with an ancient wall that's intact.
Well, so I should think that there's a lot. There's going to be a lot of hullabaloo over having Traitor Trump at the helms, and then all this. I guess what's happened in Japan is we've come to the realization that they hold a lot of elements to create nuclear war, don't they?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that again?
Well, I mean, the Japanese, while they're not a military force, they have a lot of nuclear waste and a lot of elements that have been produced in their nuclear power facilities that could perpetuate nuclear war. True?
Right. Yes. Okay, so this is one of the really dangerous aspects of the situation between Kim Jong-un, North Korea, and President Trump, is the fact that Japan has been sitting, as you say, on all of this plutonium for a number of years. They've been stockpiling it, ostensibly for their use in the commercial nuclear power industry, but of course easily convertible to nuclear weapons. And it's an extremely large stockpile of plutonium that they had separated themselves, and some of it they had separated for them in Sellafield in Great Britain. And with the fairly clear option at all times that if they no longer felt protected by the United States nuclear umbrella, that they could go it on their own and create their own arsenal.
Wow.
It's estimated that they could become a nuclear weapons power within a couple of years, because they have the ability to launch satellites. They have, you know, rocketry and knowledge. The knowledge of how to build a nuclear weapons device is pretty well known internationally. It's just getting all of the elements that you need, the fissionable materials, and having the technical ability to deliver those that are difficult. And the Japanese have, you know, pretty much everything they need in those in terms of the fissionable material and the ability to deliver it. So
isn't this the first year, though, that that this organization, as you were speaking, I was thinking that the Diet changed their laws just last year to allow them to have a military. So this is the first year since World War II where this organization will be meeting, and Japan actually has the legal right to develop something like that if they chose, because their state agreed to that. Am I incorrect on that thinking?
I'm not sure about that. You know, they've had a military force that they called their defense force. So I think it's more been a question of semantics.
Okay.
I think they've always been able to do something like this. They didn't necessarily have to call it an army. They'd still call it just a defense force, because they could claim, like a lot of countries do, that their nuclear weapons are a deterrent, not an offensive.
So what is the plan for this? What's the agenda for this meeting that you're having? Do you know what the discussions are going to be on?
This will be one of the things, is the confrontation between the United States and North Korea. But the main, I think, focus will be on the recently passed treaty in June at the United Nations, in which 122 nations negotiated and signed a nuclear weapons ban treaty, which is a historic moment in the history of diplomacy regarding nuclear weapons. It's the first time this treaty has been attempted, and it actually succeeded in passing. And what's going to need to happen now is 50 of the countries of the 122 countries that signed the treaty need to ratify it in whatever manner they do, you know, whatever the procedures are for those individual countries. And then the treaty goes into force around the world. So that's going to be, I think, probably the primary focus of the meeting
in New York. Each country needs to ratify the ban on nuclear weapons individually. And did the United States did not sign this, did it?
No. Yeah, of course. You know, there were a large number of countries that didn't participate in this negotiation. 122, I think somewhere around 130 countries were involved in the negotiation. 122 signed it. One abstained, that was Singapore, and one voted no, that was the Netherlands. And they were the only NATO country that participated in the treaty discussions. And then some of the other countries that didn't sign it just, you know, chose not to either sign or to take any position on it.
Do you know why?
But the other 122 voted in favor.
Why did they vote no?
Excuse me, what?
Why did that one country vote?
The Netherlands. The reason is that NATO's defense policy is all wrapped around the use of the threat to use nuclear weapons. You know, in a worst case scenario, if they're losing a war, they reserve the right to use nuclear weapons or in response to a nuclear weapon attack. And the United States has never forsworn its alleged right to use nuclear weapons first, even though that's something that arms control groups have been trying to get the United States to agree to for a long time, a no first use policy.
No, the government
never taken that position.
I couldn't imagine that our government will ever take a no first strike position. That's just not. If you're a war machine, you don't take that, because in order to start create wars, you have to start one. So that usually requires a first strike policy.
That's right. I mean, the United States has taken a very hypocritical position, in my opinion, regarding nuclear weapons from the beginning, that we have a unique role in the world, and none of the rules that we want to apply to everyone else should apply to us. And not every country in the world thinks that's wonderful and thinks that we're wonderful for having that policy. In fact, 122 of them just voted to ban nuclear weapons. Now, it may seem a little hollow when you consider that the nine countries that actually have nuclear weapons and are acknowledged as nuclear weapon states didn't participate, nor did any of their allies, with the exception of the Netherlands, who voted no. But this is the way, you know, it's a start. The Landmines Treaty initially was agreed to without the support of most of the countries that were the worst violators of the treaty, you know, of what became an international treaty. But those countries eventually were shamed into agreeing to going along with it. And at this point, landmines are now creating a lot less damage than they ever have as a result of that international treaty. And bit by bit, the legacy of landmines is being, systematically dug up and deactivated throughout the world. So, granted, nuclear weapons are a lot bigger task to ban than landmines are, but this is a pathway that can lead us eventually to nuclear weapons abolition, I think. And that's the hope of the people who are going to be at this conference and at a number of others. IPPNW is part of a international coalition called the International Campaign Against Nuclear Weapons, ICAN. And that was the lead group that was advocating at the United Nations to get this treaty negotiation started. So it'll be through ICAN that IPPNW and the other groups around the world will be strategizing and trying to figure out how to get the 50 countries to sign on so that the treaty then becomes international law.
Can I offer a suggestion that you might pipe up there? Is by putting pressure on those same countries who have nuclear capacity to focus their new industry on nuclear waste remediation. Because we have a massive, catastrophic problem going on every place where there's been nuclear. And if those countries could actually put let's just be clear, nuclear weapons is about making money. Nuclear industry just soaks up the beans. So let's give them the same money, but instead of perpetrating weapons and warheads, how about creating massive ways to remediate the 80, 90 years, the 700,000 years of nuclear waste that we have going on? I mean, give them the money.
That is what was supposed to happen after the end of the Cold War. You know, there was this You had treaties signed between Reagan and Gorbachev, and then, you know, the Soviet Union collapsed, and, you know, Russia inherited their nuclear weapons arsenal, and the United States and Russia were friendly, you know, at that point, and as the two main drivers of nuclear weapons expansion and the two most heavily armed and dangerous countries in the world. There was supposed to be a peace dividend, and it was talked about a lot during the George H.W. Bush administration.
Really, they called
the
it
Clinton
a dividend.
Administration.
Is that really what they called it, a dividend?
There was going to be a peace dividend, yeah, where the money that we were spending on war capability was going to start transferring into, you know, human resources and things that were useful to people, more useful to people than the military hardware, which only created destruction if it were actually used. You know, it employed people, obviously, in the factories. It employs people now in the factories that make these war machines, but and weapons, but it doesn't, you know, the end product isn't something that's helpful, obviously. Unless, of course, you're, you know, into deterrence. You know, its use is
if it's a deterrent,
is actually negative.
You only need a handful. If it's a real deterrent, you only need a handful. We don't need hundreds and thousands. I mean, and we do not need to be using depleted uranium weapons. I hope that will also be brought up there, because talking about not using no nuclear weapons, depleted uraniums are nuclear weapons that the United States is now selling and using. They changed their army manual to allow the use of depleted uranium weapons. I hope you will pipe up about that, to be honest, and ask a question and ask people to talk about it, because this is how we have gotten into this. We can talk about nuclear war as being maybe a possibility. That's my you know, once you start inching towards it, okay, so we can use nuclear weapons. Like Trump's just like, you know, mouthing off while we have these. Really, this is really dangerous what's going on in the South Pacific. Is that going to be a big topic down there?
Well, the depleted uranium is an issue that PSR and IPPNW have been trying to alert people to for quite a long time. And it's not the same as nuclear weapons explosions. It doesn't have the, you know, really massive capacity to kill people instantly in large numbers like that. But it is a really serious neurotoxin, you know, and it's the effects of dispersal of depleted uranium have been demonstrated with our own soldiers, which those reports are still being suppressed by the U.S. government because they want to continue to use.
Dr. Busby has won cases in Europe proving that long-term exposure to low-level radioactive contaminants is as much more harmful. Like, it could be, it's as catastrophic, really, in the numbers. It doesn't kill you right away, but it's harmful. Disrupts
your
entire life.
You know, as you say, we've been using depleted uranium weapons for a long time, and when I had got a chance to measure the radioactivity personally when I was in Belgrade visiting some friends several years ago, it was about 4 years ago, and we went to the still not repaired, bombed out defense ministry there in Belgrade.
When was it bombed?
During the United States attack on Belgrade during the Kosovo War in the 90s.
Using depleted uranium there too. I thought we were just using it in the Middle East and in Iraq.
No, we used it in the Yugoslav wars as well. I had a rad alert radiation detector that measured more than twice as high as the surrounding area when I stuck it over the fence at that site.
Wow.
It was normally in Belgrade, it was running about 28 to 30 counts per minute. And when I put it over the top of that, it was about 75 or 80 counts per minute.
Oh, my goodness.
So, you know, and that was just a couple blocks from our friend's house. So that was, or their apartment. And right in the middle, right in the center of Belgrade, you know, but it hasn't been, that's the one sort of site that they haven't torn down and repaired. They sort of keep that as a, you know, as a monument to remind people of that, wow, what happened. But,
25
anyway, yeah.
So high.
Oh, yeah, it was fairly high there.
And then 75. Anyway, but, I had no idea that our government used depleted uranium weapons in that war. I thought it was new.
Well, you know, they just, well, not
how
that new about that
back?
Time.
How long has it gone back that they started using
them? Well, they were using them during the first Gulf War. I know that. I mean, there were people who,
wow,
got exposures to it. That was part of the Gulf War syndrome, was people going and looking at all of these blown-up tanks, these Warthog aircraft that were using depleted uranium rounds to just blow the crap out of, you know,
I have to admit,
1,000 Iraqi tanks or something like that.
Really?
And then people were there getting souvenirs, taking pictures, you know, climbing all over these burnout tanks, and they got, some of them got really heavy exposure to the depleted uranium as a result of that. So they have,
I'm
you
having
know,
a
it,
Scooby-Doo
it, it acts,
moment right sorry. Now. I have to say, I feel like a completely illiterate American. I did not have any
Why?
Idea they went back, that our government has been using depleted uranium weapons that far back. I thought they just started it in the Iraq War. They've been using them the whole time they could, haven't they? That's really the answer. Is they don't get what the, excuse my language, I beg your pardon. They don't care what the laws are.
Well, there hasn't been any law against using depleted uranium. Should be, but you know, they've tried to, because it's such a convenient, useful military material. The United States military, just like with Agent Orange, you know, it's tried to suppress the information about it. You know, it took them forever to acknowledge Agent Orange was harming people, but now they finally have, and they're finally helping people who've been hurt by it. Not in Southeast Asia, mind you, but, you know, the United States veterans anyway. And, but that's not really happened with depleted uranium yet. One thing that happened that first Gulf War, there was,
the use of depleted uranium are part of the prohibited weapons. I'm pretty sure of it. Most countries
By whom? I'm not aware of that, but, you know, you can tell me.
Yeah, the United States did not agree to it, but most countries have agreed not to use depleted uranium weapons.
Okay, maybe there is a treaty. I'm just not aware of it. You know, this is...
Well, the United States has refused, completely decided they are not participating on it. But the use of it is, I mean, from my understanding, it's been illegal, but the United States has refused to do it.
Okay, well, I'll have to look into that. Thank you for telling me about that. But I'm not surprised. It should be illegal to use depleted uranium. And the reason is, it's not, the radioactivity is definitely part of the problem, but an even greater problem with the depleted uranium is that it basically affects the body like lead. It's the ultimate heavy metal, you know. It's not a good thing to have in your body.
Yeah.
And so if you're inhaling particles of it, it's, you know, you're getting some radiation, definitely, which can cause cancers. But you're also getting just the toxic effect of having a heavy metal in your body. It's just really bad stuff.
Well, Christopher
Busby
did.
And it can cause birth
defects. Right.
Everything.
Christopher Busby has some very definitive studies on this, and he's become somewhat of an expert on this idea, because there has been, I mean, low level. I mean, it is really bad. And are they going to talk about depleted uranium weapons there? Do you know if that's on the agenda?
I don't know. Okay. I don't know. But it's something that's on our agenda. Period. But I don't know if that'll be coming up.
I think the fact that this is one of my frustrations, to be honest, as a person who's kind of just an outside citizen and not really much of an activist, because I have like a busy life. I mean, I could, if I, somebody would pay my bills, I could be a full-time activist, but I can't be, right?
Yeah.
But,
right.
One of my frustrations is that we do not hear enough about the nuclear waste and the harm it's causing to our water, our air, our children, our bodies, causing all these illnesses. And it is at heart the waste. We have so much nuclear waste all around this country, and we are not even, you go to the doctor and you say, well, do you think it might be caused by the nuclear waste down at that, you know, the thing that comes out of there? They'll look at you and say, oh, you've been conspiratized. You know, that's a conspiracy. Nuclear waste is perfectly safe. I mean, we really need to go on attack against this. We need to have, we need to turn the tables on this, because this is literally, you know, we know that Helen Caldicott says 8 to 4 generations. We're about 4 in. We're going to start seeing some very bad things. And we already are.
Right.
How many children are born with birth defects? The NRC itself says it knows that for every 2 rads in the air for a population of 1 million, we'll get 32,000 extra cancers and leukemias, over 200,000 birth defects. What kind of quality of life are we giving up because we're refusing to address the harm caused by nuclear waste? We can protect ourselves.
Well, the thing is, we, you know, quantifying it has always been the difficulty, because you don't know what you can make predictions. You can't, but proving it, and this is what the nuclear industry, you know, hides behind, is that proving harm is difficult.
Again, that's a lie. Dr. Goffman, Dr. Pauling. That is not, it's not hard to show the
I'm talking about in an individual case. You know, it's like if somebody wants to get relief, if they get cancer, proving that they got it as a result of exposure to,
you know why?
Radioactive waste or radioactive material is not that easy to do in our legal system.
We can look at what's going on in St. Louis for that exact thing. Because nobody even looked at the oncology rates. And the way we take our oncology rates are outrageous. They ask you, well, you go to the doctor, you get cancer, you're listed as having cancer in Philadelphia. You might have been born on a radioactive nuclear dump site. They don't ask. You see, the question is, science needs to be free from corporations. Scientists need to be able to develop these ideas. Like, there must be something more than where you got your cancer. Where were you from?
Well,
where are you born? And link all those people together.
So, you know, I don't think we have to prove that people are, you know, at what rate people are harmed or whatever the rest, to just to figure out that we should not be doing our running our society based on extremely dangerous substances. You know, I mean, that's that ought to be a given. You know, it's like
exactly.
If you ask people, well, should we treat our water with cyanide, you know, so that we can, you know, get X, Y, or Z benefit from it?
Yeah.
Most people would say, no, I think that's probably not smart. That's dangerous. You know, and a lot of people feel that way about nuclear, not as many as should, but, you know, it is the same basic principle. Why would we want to get electricity from something that is so dangerous it has to be guarded out of in the environment for, you know, 100,000 years in the case of plutonium?
And
you
the
know,
fact is,
why would getting 60 years of electricity from a nuclear power plant, you know, at maximum, justify generating substances that the EPA requires at least need to be isolated for 10,000 years, which is longer than recorded civilization? You know, that's a completely absurd 20th century notion that this is a good bargain. You know, that we need to step away from this and stop doing it. Absolutely.
Completely.
And we don't have to be able to have to prove that, you know, exactly what the harm is, to understand that this is a ridiculous thing to be doing.
Yeah, it is. It is. Not only is it a ridiculous thing to be doing, but it is antithetical to life.
It's immoral, knowing what we know.
Yeah. Exactly.
Exactly.
And when at the time, okay, there was not enough, quote, alternative ideas that were marketable on a large scale. This seemed to make sense. I'm willing to give a pass. Like, I'm not out for their heads. I'm not into one of these people that wants to put the guillotines out. I call myself a truth nuker, not an anti-nuker. I don't want to, like, off with their heads because they know they've been lying to us for 70 years. I'm willing to call a truce. Let's just move forward and figure it out because we can't keep building new nuclear wars. We can't build new nuclear weapons. We have to stop the use of nuclear weapons, including depleted uranium, and have a shift change. Have a shift change to, like, this has become the biggest, in my view, issue, ignored issue of all time. They have taken their diaper and just smeared it all over the wall for the last 80 years, and everybody's like, wow, don't we love the new color brown on the walls now? It's really great. I mean, no, that's just, you know, at some point that's going to be toxic. We've got to just stop it because we need fresh air. You know what I mean? It's really unreasonable, man. So, Chuck, we have about 20 minutes left, 25 minutes left. What else have you been working on? What else would you like to share with our audience?
Well, you know, because I'm here in the Northwest, in located in Portland, we have a couple of issues we continue to work on. We're trying to close our last nuclear power reactor out at Hanford.
CGS.
The Columbia Generating Station, nuclear plant, which is the former Washington Public Power Supply System, nuclear project number two.
Did that go when they said plants. That it was really expensive to run? I remember the last time we talked, you said it might be closing because it hasn't met its own charter. Has all of that come to fore, or have they had any of that discussion since we talked?
The public power agencies that built this plant and run this plant, there's 27 publicly owned utilities in Washington that have a board that govern the plant, are still, I think, in deep denial about both the danger of this plant and also the cost of it. They're still feeling the need to justify, as I was starting to say, they tried to build five nuclear power plants and only completed one of them and then defaulted on two, and the bondholders lost most of their money. It was the largest municipal bond default in the history of the United States at the time. This was in 1984. And then the other two that weren't finished, we're still paying in our Bonneville rates. It's 36% of Bonneville's electric rates that it charges its customers go to nuclear projects.
Wow.
Two of which were never finished.
36%?
Yes, and only 10% of the electricity comes from the Columbia Generating Station. So that's,
well, I'm
going to
jump
it's
in
a
here
burden.
And ask you, do you think the EWEB pays 36% of it, it's what it pays to Bonneville? To, like, does 36% of my money that I pay to EWEB that goes to Bonneville pay for nuclear?
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah, the rates are, you know, it's
no
it's merged
wonder that
in
guy
with the
wouldn't
hydro.
Call me back. I called the guy who was my water representative at EWEB like five or six times. Never got a call back. No wonder. I'm going to have to go to a meeting and see to his face.
It's sort of a verboten topic in public power circles. Because there was so much unpleasantness over these whoops reactors. That's what they call them. WPPSS was shortened with the nickname whoops. And so there was so much anger and frustration when they canceled those four reactors. And a lot of these utilities felt like that was a bad decision, you know, even though the power wasn't needed and these things had gone way over budget. So the folks that support nuclear energy, including the publicly owned utilities in the Tri-Cities area right around Hanford that really like nuclear energy and like things nuclear, have been in, just as they were in the forefront when they were trying to build these things, they're in the forefront now, influencing the rest of the public power movement to believe, still hold out the nuclear dream. And in fact, there is discussion of building a new nuclear reactor system out in Idaho, and the Energy Northwest, which is this Washington group of 27 publicly owned utilities, would operate that reactor system. Interestingly, when they were given the choice or the option of advocating for building the first one at Hanford and owning it themselves, the large utilities and most of the utilities in Energy Northwest turned that down. So even though, you know, on the surface they're pro-nuclear, they understand that the uncertainty of the economics of it is pretty bad. So this reactor system, if it were built in Idaho, and they're hoping to build this system by 2026 is their goal. It used to be 2024 as of November last year, but now they've pushed it back 2 years. Would be another group of publicly owned utilities in Utah, Utah Associated Municipal Power Systems. And again, it's the public sector that seems to be sort of immune to the economic risks of this. Private utilities in the West are not in the slightest bit interested in pursuing nuclear energy because they know it's an unsafe risk, and they don't, according to the way they are regulated, they would have to assume all of that risk until the thing was completed.
Why is the public sector even interested in it if the private sector is not? Like, what is the gain? Why is this being pushed on us if even private sector says, no way, we can't make it work?
Because there's two things pushing for it right now. One is the old thing, which is the belief in the in nuclear that kind of goes back to the nuclear engineering departments of universities around the country, and also the nuclear navy. A lot of power managers who go to work for these publicly owned utilities are naval veterans who were involved in the naval nuclear program. And they believe in nuclear energy. So and engineers have been trying to figure out ways to make nuclear power plants safer and more economical. And there are many, many different designs out there that have been discussed and considered, and some that have been invested in, including this one that from Corvallis, the NuScale system that was bought out by the giant Fluor Corporation, and that's who's been funding this plan for Idaho. Is Fluor, and the U.S. government has also been funding research. Half of their expenses for developing this reactor thus far have come from our tax dollars.
Isn't Fluor the company, the one that didn't do so well in France, if I recall?
No, that's Areva and Electricity de France, and they have, again, the nuclear power industry in new build in the West, you know, in Europe and the United States, has been suffering a whole series of failures,
I have been looking up this DU issue while you've been chatting, and I check this out. Nuclear weapons are considered in basically the humanitarian law and environmental law are based on the principles of precaution and proportionality, and states should adhere to that. So that they say that the use of uranium ammunition is not in conformity with existing international and human rights law. But there's nothing explicitly banning it. So maybe you could bring that up, like add on to there the use of nuclear weapons, depleted uranium weapons. Because that's
an interesting one. I wonder if they considered that. I don't know. I can ask about that.
I would, you know, put an amendment to that, because honestly, I'm on this ban depleted uranium uranium.org, and it has a question about this, and there's quite a long. I've come to this page before. I actually somehow in my head I thought that what they did is they passed two resolutions at the UN commissions in 1996 and 16, they renewed it in 1997/36, state that the use of uranium ammunition is not in conformity with existing international law and human rights law, but it's not explicitly banned. So you are correct, but it has been
sort of demean. You know what I mean? Like, it's not something that people, they've agreed. There's a whole list of states who have agreed not to use it. But not having it on the, I mean, actually, I believe it's part of the use of nuclear weapons. I don't think it can be divorced from nuclear weapons. It is a nuclear weapon, very low grade. But, I mean, look at Chris Busby's work. I mean, unequivocally, he has won cases in Europe all over the place because of it, because of the work that he's shown. And you'll hear about it when you go to London, actually. And I would be quite surprised if he didn't meet some of the people that know of his work and can show you articles, like, firsthand. It's quite fascinating. You can look it up. It's, his work has been really definitive. I mean, to be honest.
Well, he is English, you know, so he may be there himself. Who knows? I didn't see his name on the list of speakers, though. If he were there, I think he would have.
Well, there might be people. I don't think he's going to be there, but there's going to be a list. Who is speaking? Do you know any of the names, any of the people that are going to be
there? I can send you the list.
That would be awesome.
You know, I'm relatively new to the international work, so I'm not as familiar.
Well, if you send me the list, we have some time. I can add it, because this is actually going to air on the 23rd of August. So we have.
I'll just send you a link.
Yeah, and I'll add that link. And by the way, and I want to thank a kind of a new affiliate, and I totally forgot to do this at the beginning of the show. I have been invited to air our shows on KEPW.org in Eugene, the first FM station. They gave out like 18 FM stations in the country, and it's one of the few here, KEPW.org, Rick Gold's organization, Eugene Peaceworks. So it's KEPW, Eugene Peaceworks. Get it? It was pretty easy.
Wow.
Yeah. And so they have an FM station, and they are now playing Libby Halevy's show, Nuclear Hot Seat, and they have asked me to start putting on my show. So this is why, like, I'm making an effort not to cuss, because it's an FM station, so we have to go by those FCC rules. So my language, it's done me a lot of good, because it's cleaned up my language.
Well, I think it's, I mean, it's cathartic to swear, but, you know, probably not.
Well, it comes out so easy when there's so much frustration. See, the thing is, when there's a lot of frustration, it slips out. But, you know, we have to use actually words. And there's a reason behind, you know, using the FCC rules actually did, in a way, elevate the conversation to a higher level of intellectuality, because you have to think about what your words are. You have to be deliberate. And that's the point. So right now in America, we're suffering from people going, I have my right to free speech to call you whatever I want. Well, you can say whatever you want in your own private house, but you can't harass me. You can't denigrate me publicly. You can't demean people it publicly.
Right.
That's not freedom of speech. That's harassment. You know, that's hate
speech.
I think
that's true.
So there's a difference. You can feel how you feel, but you know what? Keep it to yourself, pal. Yeah, really, and you can't, and you have to, like, be nonviolent.
Or use the broad spectrum of the English language.
No, I personally disagree with calling people snowflakes. I really don't believe
that. Oh, yeah, well.
And I disagree with saying punch a fascist or punch a Nazi. I disagree with promoting violence. Like, I disagree with both ends of that. It's not right. None of it.
I know.
We have to get our discourse.
We should not be giving any excuses for Trump to be able to list moral equivalency. I mean, obviously, he got a lot of grief for doing it, which is great. But, you know, when people are using violence on our side and aggressively pushing it, I agree. I think that's a mistake.
Well, I think that's
the strength of the civil rights movement was that it was clearly nonviolent, and it just exposed the inherent violence of the system that was there. And that it's harder to see that when our side is also being violent, being aggressively violent.
But you know what? Violence on our side is really minimal. A lot of the aggressive violence is it's pushback. What happens is they push back. They're not going to take it.
Right.
And then when they overtake, they're like, look, those guys are beating us up because they're stronger. They shouldn't have picked a fight. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, that is the problem. That, you know, when you get into the mud with a pig, you know, the pig likes it. So that's the, and you get muddy.
You know, a lot of people like fighting in the mud with a pig. Let's just be clear. A lot of people enjoy the fight. So, I mean, there has to be.
This
is all part of the whole. But this isn't this is the American experiment, except that right now I believe we're in a dangerous, dangerous time because we have a White House that is filled with no advisors, no professional advisors, a small, very ultra-rich family running the show who have all been granted national security clearances and who are still getting national security information, and military advisors all around the president. The only ones left are the military or mega corporate guys. Yeah. And a Congress who are can't wait to get back in and start taking away money from poor people. That's, to be honest, this is going to be a time when the Republicans are going to spank America hard for electing them. And that's what I don't know what, you know, like I don't know what's going to happen, but it doesn't feel so good.
Well,
I do get to go to England and be
the good part is that people fought back on the health care thing to the point where the Republicans really didn't have the votes to repeal and replace or really do anything. And I think it became clear to the public generally that the Republicans didn't have a plan, and that scared people. People said, they're going to take away my health care, and they're not going to replace it with anything or anything I'm going to want. And I think that their agenda is starting to unravel. I really do. You know, they've got control, and yet they can't do anything.
You mean
hopefully.
They're
doing plenty in the agencies right now. EPA is being dismantled. You know, there's a lot of dangerous stuff happening right now that doesn't require Congress to do anything, but you know, we have a chance to get back control and to get Trump out. I mean, I think he is so dangerous, he has to be gotten out, if for no other reason than him having the nuclear weapons capability.
I think
he is a dangerous man. Even the military, I think, is nervous about him, which, you know, we should not have to be relying on the military, who are trained to follow commands, to protect us from a dangerous president. We need to get him out as quickly as possible.
I think he's going to quit.
You know, even if he's replaced by Pence, who I loathe and do not think, you know, very much of at all. Pence is not an insane person who wants to, you know, who's more concerned about his own ego than the lives of millions of people that would be put at threat.
If Mike Pence becomes president, they're going to push for re-education camps. They're going to push, I mean, fortunately, they are going to push people back, but I agree with you. He's not the kind of person who will subvert the system like Trump has been doing. Trump has literally...
Well, and he's not going to say, you know, oh, North Korea hurt my feelings, I think I'm going to nuke them, you know, which Trump might, you know. He said, well, I'm going to call his bluff, you know. Well, okay.
Well, see,
he's got plenty of firepower to...
Now that Kim Jong-un is backed down, supposedly backed down. So they consider that a big win for Trump. I personally think that Kim Jong-un is a CIA asset, so you can laugh at that idea, too. But I think that
where do you get that?
Look at it. That's another whole conversation if you want, but there's a whole lineup. And
okay.
I actually think that Trump has been set up by the CIA. I consider him to be Pinochet 2.0. We did not have a fake military coup here. We had a fake election from the get-go, with the Democrats stealing the primary, with Trump squeaking his way in. I mean, the whole thing stinks.
So you think the CIA didn't think Hillary was supportive enough and they wanted Trump instead?
I have no idea what the real reason is, but Hillary was sabotaged and gutted at the last minute. So I have no idea.
She definitely was, but I don't think the CIA was in on it. I think the intelligence agencies are unhappy that Trump's there because he's so totally unpredictable.
He's completely
I think they have no idea
how insane this guy is. When he got to the White House, they probably went, oh, my God, we had no idea.
Exactly.
They had no
this was not a CIA-planned plot. I don't think. I mean, if it was, it backfired.
Chuck, I have to say, he has stirred up my PTSD from my childhood abuse because I have seen this program before. Let me tell you what. Mm-hmm. We have not seen anything yet. This guy, he is a true abuser. After this last week, he's cooking up something big. He's either going to quit or he's cooking up something big, and he is going to spank the American people hard. My guess is he's going to beat the crap out of us before we get him out of office. We're going to have to be like the battered wife who's in the hospital with strangle marks on her neck going, I can't take you anymore. I mean, seriously.
I think you're right. He's demonstrated throughout his career that he's completely shameless. Mm. He can't be shamed into doing things.
What I have to say is it shocks me that there's Americans who think that he's a good guy and that I'm like some left-wing snowflake who sees it all in evil about him. And I think he's a true abuser. He paid $1 million.
Absolutely.
I mean, he is a misogynist. The vile language that he was heard on saying before the elections with just a few short years earlier. It wasn't like 30 years ago when he was now on the Howard Stern show. It was like 7 or 8 years earlier. He was still talking like he did on the Howard Stern show.
Right.
But look, we have just a few minutes. The time is ticking here. We have about 8 minutes. I want to ask you about if you know anything about the movement against the, what is it, H.R. 3053, the Nuclear Waste Policy Amendment Act of 2017, where they want to have us give up our federal rights for water and allow the nuclear waste to be dumped in our rivers. Do you know anything
well,
about
that?
Well,
it's basically, yeah, it looks as though a change to the Nuclear Waste Policy Act is likely to pass the House. It hasn't passed yet, and that's interesting in and of itself. And what it would do is restart the process for siting our nation's high-level radioactive waste dump at Yucca Mountain in Nevada, which is a totally inadequate site. It's been proven to be inadequate by studies. It has water intrusion at a much higher rate than would be ideal for a site like that.
Would it fund it or approve it?
It would. There's a separate funding bill, but this would restart it through legislation. You know,
that's not
funding
even the worst part of it. It's the other stuff that's attached.
And I was getting to the second part. The second part is that it would allow interim storage sites in voluntary communities to store high-level radioactive waste on a, quote, temporary basis, end quote, until a permanent disposal site is established. And there are communities in Texas and New Mexico that are being threatened by this proposal that have companies there that are interested in trying to get a waste dump like that. And there are communities around the country with nuclear power plants, some of which have been closed, that are anxious to have their high-level waste taken away from their community and taken somewhere else.
Do we know any congresspeople that are on the fence that we could call and say, hey, because like I've actually called Schrader here, who's a co-signer. What I do is I look up and see who's a co-signer on the bill, and I call the ones mm-hmm. in our area and say, relook at this, and I actually faxed them over Donna Gilmore's page about what this policy act will mean to us, what it really means, because most of them do not even know the biggest harm. She's created a really great worksheet that explains.
You're in the Eugene area. I would contact DeFazio. The more no votes we get, the better.
I have contacted DeFazio's office for sure, but he's not a co-signer.
Blumenauer, all of the Oregon reps definitely should be talked to, and our senators are even more important because this is, if it ever comes to a vote on the floor of the House, this will pass.
You know what's stopping it right now?
You want to know what's stopping it?
What?
What's stopping it is the fact that there is no separate nuclear waste fund at the federal level. Companies that have nuclear power plants have been required to put money in to the federal government for high-level radioactive waste disposal, and that's been true from the beginning.
Right.
So they've been contributing money, but it's just like Social Security. It goes into the general fund, and then there's a credit there, but there's no actual cash sitting in an account that you can then disperse. They have to get authorization from Congress to release money that is credited to this account. And the way the Republicans have set up the budget these days, in order to do that, if you add money to the budget in one place, you have to take away money somewhere else. And so this is creating a problem for them. If they want to actually get these processes going, they have to spend general fund money. And they have to find a way of, something else that they're going to cut that would replace it. And so this is a problem the Republicans have created for the nuclear power industry. And it's kind of fascinating. The other part of it is the nuclear power industry itself has been getting off with saving some money in recent years, because when Yucca Mountain got canceled by Obama, they went to the courts and said, hey, there's no permanent disposal site being investigated by the federal government. We shouldn't have to keep paying into this waste fund. And in fact, we should be able to get money back for storing it on our own sites. So right now, they're not having to put money into the waste fund. They're able to take money from the feds for their dry cast storage at reactor sites. And with so many of these reactors having financial difficulty competing in the market, they don't necessarily want to go back to having to put money back into the waste fund. So, wow. It's an interesting dynamic that pushes against, that counterintuitively pushes against them passing this bill. So it'll be interesting to see if it ever emerges out of the House.
Suggest anybody who listens to this podcast to please go to H.R. 3053, Nuclear Waste Policy Amendment Act of 2017, and look up the co-sponsors and call those representatives that are in your area and ask them to change their minds and vote no on this when it comes to shove and take their names off.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because our voices matter.
Senator Wyden, and call Senator Merkley if you're in Oregon or wherever state you're in where you're hearing this. Call your two U.S. senators and tell them what an irresponsible bill this is.
Exactly.
Because temporarily, setting up a temporary storage site and shipping this extremely dangerous material that's lethal, if spent nuclear fuel, if you're standing next to a fuel assembly when it's freshly out of the reactor, you would die within a minute just from the exposure to the radiation. 10 years later, it would take you only about 2 minutes to get a lethal dose.
And this also eliminates environmental impact reports for transport of this lethal stuff too. So it's very,
exactly,
very dangerous.
So
bill.
You should if you're going to transport spent nuclear fuel, you want to. First off, you probably want to have it cool down a bit if you're going to be transporting it very far, so that the lethality is at least somewhat reduced. And secondly, you only want to move it once. You want to move it to the permanent repository. You don't want to move it across the country to one place on a temporary basis and then have to move it again to the permanent disposal site.
Amen to that. Well, Chuck, guess what? We have only 1 minute left, but that's a great place to end. I want to thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Lonnie Clark and Chuck Johnson from Orion Physician for Social Responsibility. And I want to welcome our new family at KEPW.org. You can listen to them online also. So thanks, Chuck, for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's really great. Thanks for having me, Lonnie.
Yes, and put your courage feet on, you guys. It is really up to us. Our voices matter. We have to lean into this if we want to help our planet remediate itself and help build our culture. So, again, thanks, Chuck, for joining us. Put your courage feet on. We will talk to you guys soon. We'll have links in the aftermath. We'll talk to you later.
Bye.